Good morning. On Tuesday, we got ourselves a new Taoiseach.
Anish, current vote on Shin that Dáil Éireann nominates Deputy Simon Harris for appointment by the President to be Taoiseach. Result, Tá 88, Níl 69. I confirm, therefore,
the confirmation of Simon Harris as Taoiseach, and then the speech.
Whilst I am proudly the leader of Fine Gael, I will lead a coalition of three parties. And today, I sincerely promise to be a Taoiseach for all. No matter your political persuasion, I will work with you and for the country that I know we all love. I will be a Taoiseach who will listen. And my message is simple. I want to work every day to improve the lives of all in this country. Fueled by hope and driven by a vision of a better Ireland, I will provide a new leadership and a new energy, and I intend to act decisively in the best interests of our people. Let us not make the mistake of giving in to pessimism and despair about our future. History has been written in Dáil Éireann so many times since January 1919. We can and must write it again by rising above partisan politics, by working together to solve the greatest challenges of our time. The people expect us to do more. We should demand of ourselves no less. Gairmín Amhail.
At 37, Simon Harris was the youngest Taoiseach in the land. His speech was ambitious, but as many pointed out, he would certainly face difficulties. With Clare, journalist and commentator Alison O'Connor.
A pre-existing coalition, a relationship that he has to slot into with two other party leaders, a programme for government, less than a year left in office, and trying to rejuvenate his party.
It's a big ask.
It's a very big ask.
And don't forget a looming election. Here's Dr. Teresa Reedy, lecturer in the Department of Government and Politics at UCC.
There are local and European Parliament elections coming up in just under 2 months now. And in about 2 weeks' time, this story is going to fade into the background very quickly. And all of the bandwidth and the political time is going to be allocated to those elections. And so there's very little that he's going to be able to substantively achieve in that time period. We then move into the summer period, which is actually usually a good period for governments because the Dáil isn't sitting and there isn't a lot of criticism of the government. But a lot of the speculation will immediately be about the upcoming budget. And that's really the crucial policy decision for Harris, because the money that you allocate really signals your intent. But he doesn't even have exclusive control over that. That
yes.
is an agreed document that will be the vision of the three parties. But ultimately, Simon Harris is not going to be able to do anything substantive at this stage on the kind of major challenges that this government has been grappling with for 4 years and that effectively Fine Gael has been dealing with almost 14 now at this mm-hmm. stage.
Oh yes, the business of politics is relentless. And all eyes were on that cabinet reshuffle.
And picking that cabinet and watching the politicians greeting Simon Harris as he came out here at Leinster House on his way to the Auras, like studying a parade ring before a big race, some looking nervous, some looking excited about what his cabinet may have in store later on.
And of course, when choosing a cabinet, there are considerations not just confined to the issue of ability. Fielding this somewhat exasperated text into Clare, Professor of Modern History at UCD, Dermot Ferriter.
This whole debate about Munster or Connacht ministers sums up everything that's wrong with Irish politics. Parochialism, clientism, localism at its worst. Ministers should be selected on their abilities and their qualifications and are there to work for the country instead of being considered some sort of super county councillors. The media is just as bad at feeding this narrative as well. When will we ever grow up as a nation regarding these matters?
I agree with that. It's important on a day like today to remember that this is a very robust democracy. What's going to go on in Leinster House today is a very serious business. It's unprecedented, obviously, to have three Taoiseach within such a short space of time. But our democracy can withstand that and can handle it quite well. There are very few countries in the world that can make the claim that we can, that we've had over a century now of an unbroken democracy. So that's an important point. But within that, we have developed a particular style of politics which that text is alluding to in relation to the triumph of localism. And when a leader is looking at their options, that they are constantly reminded that geography has to be as important as other considerations. And it shouldn't be the case. It's a fair criticism. Because at the same time, we would get told...
You have to get re-elected. That's part of democracy,
You do. Well, I mean, hasn't this always been the case, you know, in relation to what you prioritise, given the scale of the serious issues that are facing the country and are facing politicians, that they can become far too consumed within our political culture in those kind of priorities? So it should be about public service as opposed to having to satisfy those particular regional and geographic considerations. That would be in an ideal political world, which we don't live in.
However, with an interesting counter-viewpoint, back to Teresa Reedy.
I do think we also need to realise that the country is not entirely homogenous, and representation is an important part of the political process and decision-making process. It's actually quite important that you have diversity in your decision-making group. And so we speak a lot about gender, but geography is actually part of that. And it's important that you have the interests of very different communities around the country reflected at the decision-making table.
From the Clare Byrne Show on Tuesday, but before the day was out, Junior Minister Peter Burke was appointed Minister for Enterprise, Trade and Employment, and Junior Minister Patrick O'Donovan became Minister for Higher Education, Research, Innovation and Science. The day after, Rachel brought us this.
Almost all of this morning's front pages feature photos of the new Taoiseach and his wife and children. There's also a general consensus that he played it safe with yesterday's cabinet reshuffle. The Independent says that Simon Harris kept his friends close and his enemies even closer. The Irish Times says there was no blood on the carpet, while the Mail quotes an unnamed Fine Gael source as saying that Mr Harris bottled a plan to move Helen McEntee from the Department of Justice. The Examiner cautions that hope and positivity won't be enough to deliver on the challenges faced by the government.
And amidst all of the ceremony and fanfare from the opposition, a general shrug of the shoulders to the whole thing. On Drive Time, Louise O'Reilly of Sinn Féin.
What we saw today and what we are seeing unfolding in front of us is simply a commitment to more of the same. And they have their programme for government. There'll be no new energy. There'll be no new ideas. There'll be no new vision. It will be more of the same. And I genuinely do not believe that that is what people want.
I mean, new faces, Patrick O'Donovan, higher education. Peter Burke will be new again, as you say, in enterprise. We're also learning Hildegard Nocton will remain as chief whip. Helen McEntee remains as justice minister.
Not that many new faces, really.
But there are some, and probably more in terms of ministers of state tomorrow.
A lot more of the same. So, you know.
And like many in the opposition, she wanted a general election.
If he is that confident in his ideas, if he is that confident in his government and their track record with their partners, Fianna Fáil and the Green Party, well, then let him take that to the people to get the mandate.
How do you respond to that, Niall Collins?
Well, the Fianna Fáil TD said that he simply did not believe that there was an appetite for a general election.
Look, the public will get a general election at the end of our five-year term in government. I think it shows that we are a mature democracy, that we can put together a multi-party coalition. This is the norm across Europe.
But not everybody in Fianna Fáil or even Fianna Fáil in Limerick believes you're right. Willie O'Dea thinks this is the wrong approach.
And Willie O'Dea is entitled to his opinion, of course, and he's entitled to articulate his opinion. And as Micheál Martin said in his speech in the Dáil today, we consulted widely with our membership. We had a full vote or plebiscite within our membership prior to entering the government. After the programme for government was agreed, it went to our membership. It was endorsed by our parliamentary party. And that's exactly what we're doing. We're delivering on the key priorities within our programme for government across all of the areas. You just look at our economy, it is very, very strong.
So more delivery, Louise, we have full under a new Taoiseach.
We're addressing
God,
the issues
more
in
more delivery,
more of the same, and Niall is absolutely nailing it.
Let's get a response from Louise.
Of course, Niall, let's get a response from Louise. To be fair to Niall, he had a good run there to outline that he believes absolutely nothing is going to change. So we've got...
Duking it out on Tuesday's Drive Time. The next day it was back to business, and in the Dáil it was leaders' questions. But the absence of the new Taoiseach drew the ire of the opposition. On Late Debate with Colm, this analysis from political correspondent at the Sunday Times, Claire Scott.
Sharp criticisms for the Taoiseach not being in the Dáil. He wasn't able to say unsure when the name was called earlier. What was going on?
Well, yeah, it was his first full day as Taoiseach, Mary Lou MacDonald, kind of making the point that, look, they were all there for work and he wasn't there, despite kind of the speeches over the last number of days and weeks, kind of mentioning at the Ardèche that he was ready to hit the ground running, so to speak, but then wasn't present before them to take questions. I think Ivana Bacik, Labour leader, backed up Mary Lou, and Catherine Murphy of the Soc Dems also kind of making the point that, you know, he said yesterday that he wanted to be more collegial with the opposition. He was going to reach the hand across the Dáil floor, so to speak, and on his first day, nowhere to be found. What was particularly interesting, though, was Mary Lou MacDonald making a video outside the Dáil, calling him out, so to speak, for not being present.
She doing was a there, kind of a Where's Simon video, was
much,
it? Chef?
Pretty much kind of saying, look, I'm here to debate health, to debate housing, and where are you? And then quickly, in Simon Harris style, he came out with his own video, kind of outlining that, look, he was on the phone with the UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. He'd be talking with Ukrainian Prime Minister Zelensky later on in the day, and that he was also talking to Mary Lou's counterpart in the north, Michelle O'Neill, and Emma Little Pengelly as well. So trying to outline how busy he was. There was also a couple of press releases after that from Simon Harris's office too, outlining the work that he was doing that day. So obviously she hit a nerve.
From late debate. Meanwhile, we turn our eyes to a different gladiatorial arena. It could be argued that the world is divided into two kinds of people. The sport billies.
You look all happy and excited, you know, well, the weekend ahead of you.
It's a great weekend ahead. And
our Desmond. And then the other kind.
I call you a musician, writer and historical entertainer.
In short, artsy types. Represented here by Paddy Colovan with Oliver. And yes, we know, just about, that Leinster goes up against their mortal enemies La Rochelle in the Champions Cup rugby later. But in a twisted piece of evil, Colovan was sent to review the Leinster-Leicester game last weekend. Leinster won. But given that he gleefully confessed to knowing very little about the rules of rugby, and caring less, the review focused quite a lot on the ambiance.
As they say, lighting great, everybody dressed in blue, Leinster and all of this, but very subdued.
Mm-hmm.
The game started and then Leinster scored early, whatever that is, where they went over the line and scored a try.
Scored a try.
And then there was something else that they had to do then. There was a break and then they kicked the ball over a
pole. The conversion, yeah.
The conversion. And then there was a 75-second break or something like that.
Yeah, that is
and then I was like, this is great. They've done it. Because I thought the rules were first to score, game over. But they've
sure,
won.
Sure.
And then this went on for another 38 minutes, Oliver. Then there was a 15-minute break and then they did it all again, repeatedly, for another 40 minutes. And
did you?
My problem is I'm in the music world, so like if Queen came on and played the same song for 2 hours, everyone would get bored.
Stop so you for have 20 to do minutes. Something.
So they should change the rules every 5 minutes.
Time. I'd love a half time.
I'd say they're sharpening the quills in the sports department. But what did he make of the audience? Well, as you might expect from the oval ball peeps, very well behaved.
People were getting up. Yes, they were getting their four packs of their little holders with four rock shores in them and all of this. And it was very posh. I have to say now.
Oh, it was a very posh crowd.
Well, yeah. I mean, like one of the guys beside me was, you know, the kind of complaints, that's terrible, ref. Like that was one of the complaints.
That's as rough as
it got. There was a good country fella behind me from Wicklow or Carlow or somewhere, and he was cursing and stuff. And every time someone kicked a ball, he'd go, you know, with interest. Go on, with interest. You know,
that's an interesting.
Yeah, there was good stuff.
With interest.
Yeah, with interest. And then there was a guy dressed as a teddy bear going around, dun 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 dun, Leinster. And everybody was saying Leinster, but in a very posh way, right? But then they'd have their own cheer, which is Leinster, Leinster. And that would last five Leinsters, but because there was no change or verse or chorus or middle eight even, the melody never changed, Oliver. And so therefore...
But the enthusiasm just dies
away. It just kind of petered out the whole time. And like there should be a good Leinster song.
Oh, but the food though, the food. Have a listen to this.
The menu was great because they had like Buddha beet burger. You could get a shredded barbecue of jackfruit, a house tomato chutney, paprika onions and a Coughlin vegan brioche bap. And even the curry chips was called katsu style curry fries.
Oh, yes.
So I had some curry fries. It was only curry fries, Oliver, but they put katsu there to make it sound more South South.
Curry chips. Curry chips.
But finally, sport does serve a purpose, albeit a dark one.
If this is how people enjoy themselves rather than going to war or something like that, in the eventual beautiful future Ireland that we have, if this is the worst we can get up to, I think, you know, that's an aspiration in itself.
Paddy Cullivan with Oliver. Desmond will be hunting you down. Back in a bit. Welcome back. They do say you've got to suffer for your art. Not a problem for mezzo-soprano Laura Bowler. In her piece advert coming to the National Concert Hall, she sings while she gets a tattoo. Take it away, Culture File.
I'm very interested in tattooing and what it means and why people get tattoos and why I got a tattoo for the first time. It wasn't until I was 27, so it's quite late. The piece is all about kind of how we advertise ourselves to our chosen kind of societal tribes, what things we do, the way we dress, the way we talk, the music we listen to, the films we watch. Tattoos are obviously an aspect of that. And for me, obviously, they're a huge part of my identity as I've got them in, all over my body. So that's one of the reasons why the piece is in it. But also, I was generally just really interested in how it would affect me whilst I was singing, to be tattooed at the same time as singing, and the viscerality of that, both for the audience, but also for me as a performer, and what that kind of stimulates in you energy-wise as you're performing. That combination of the two different kinds of adrenaline that you get is just being absolutely wired, totally wired, and horrifically exhausted the next day.
The truly magnificent world of Culture File. On Sunday with Miriam, Sinead Gleeson. After writing essays and editing anthologies, Hagstone is her first foray into the novel form, and it's been a while in the writing. But first, that title.
Tell me about the name, Hagstone. Where does that come from?
Yeah, people have asked me about this. I love the word, and I think some people, maybe people who live by the coast, might know what a hagstone is, but it's a stone that you find on a beach that has one hole bored all the way through it. And in some cultures, they're called adder's stones, snake's eggs, witch's stones. But apparently I heard about them because some people think of them as lucky charms. Fishermen would tie them to their boats to keep them safe, or people would tie them to stables to keep their animals safe. And another aspect is that some people say that if you hold the hole up to your eye and look through it, you're meant to see another version of the world. And my main character is an artist, so that kind of, all of those things sort of appealed to me. And it's set on an island, so it just kind of, that was the title. When it stuck, I was like, yeah, that's what it has to be called.
And that central character is Nell, a land artist intimately connected to the island.
She lives on her own, but she's been involved with lots of the men on the island. And, you know, the book, I suppose, one of the parts of the book is about desire. And if you live in a small place, whether that's an island or a small town, everybody knows your business. Everybody talks about you. If you're a woman on your own and, you live a certain kind of life, people will talk about you even more, I'm sure. But for me, the island was, for her, it's linked to her life because she's an artist. And the kind of art that she makes is land art and durational art. So she makes a lot of art on the beaches with the landscape. It's informed by the tides. It's art that's very temporary, that's very hard to sell, if you like. So her existence is even more difficult because it isn't the kind of stuff you can stick in a gallery. But yet the island informs the work. The island is literally the backdrop and the canvas for the work that she makes. So her whole, one of the struggles in the book is, if I leave here, even though it's hard to live and she's broke a lot of the time, will I make the same kind of art? Will I not be an artist anymore? So she's very bound, very tethered to this place, not just because of the art, but because I think some of the people on the island too.
And she told Miriam that this was a book that she had started, abandoned, and then started again.
I mean, I did desperately try and, shove it off a cliff metaphorically and just go, leave me alone. But it just wouldn't. It kind of left me there. And I think we're all living lives that it's very hard to find time for yourself, for the things that you love. And that's not necessarily writing. That could be, just meeting your friends or travelling or, training with a GAA club, whatever it is. And I think that I made a decision that I also got really curious. I wanted to know what was going to happen. And I think people think, writing a book is something you do in a couple of years and it's really easy. It isn't. But I also think it's something that most people can do if you sit down and try. I think loads of people have stories to tell. And don't be disheartened if it doesn't happen in one go and you hear people writing a draft in 6 months, and that's extremely rare. It takes a lot of work. I think I mentioned earlier, the great Dermot Bulger said, novels are cranked out on consistent rainy Tuesday afternoons. And they are, they are a lot of sitting on your own in a room when it's dull and it's quite lonely. But they take time, but they are worth it. And I do think that... People shouldn't give up. If you have half a novel in a drawer or half a short story, take it out today and have a look at it, you know. And also that fresh eyes thing of looking at something you haven't looked at in a while, you see all the things that are wrong. You also see the things that excited you about it, which is kind of the thing that happened with Hagstone. I wanted to finish it. I wanted to know what would happen to Nell and this island and the people on it.
Sinéad Gleeson with Miriam. But for Academy Award-winning director and screenwriter Neil Jordan with Ray, the whole process seemed a little more straightforward, or at least that's how he tells it. He's written a memoir.
It'll be out in June. I've written a memoir, yeah.
How was that for you?
It was weird. It was fun. It was weird, though. You know, I mean, it's weird looking at your own life and looking at the various things you've done. And,
yeah.
You know, actually looking at your parents' lives and, you know... Not, you know, I mean, I was just asked to write it, so I began writing it, I thought, and I wrote one chapter about my mother when she was kind of ill, driving up back to the place she was born, and I said, and I just kept writing and writing and writing, and it eventually came up with something that people seemed to regard as interesting, so.
And this is its title.
Amnesiac.
Amnesiac, yeah.
Right.
Now, I just chose that name because actually there wasn't a book called Amnesiac.
Right.
And I said, okay, I'm going to have that title. But it also has some relevance because we're never sure that we remember correctly, are we?
No.
You know?
No.
And any one person's memory, even my sister's or my, you know, my kids or my wife's memory of any one event could be quite different from your own memory
yes.
of it, you know. So I've just called it Amnesiac because there's a bit of a pun there as well.
It's fascinating. I've read a lot about memory and we replace things. Every time we remember something, the next time we remember it differently. Because if you tell a story about something that happened to you, you might embellish it slightly and that becomes, in your head, sometimes factual. So the next time...
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've told stories that... I'm convinced I witnessed that I know I never witnessed, you know. Particularly before, you know, particularly before you reach the age of kind of memory itself, really, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure everybody has some kind of imagined memory of themselves being in a pram or something like that.
But you couldn't have any
sure,
memory of it.
You're never
yes.
sure whether it was you remember that or your parents told you or the vista you saw was a photograph
yeah.
that reminds you of something. And you know.
It's fascinating. And by calling it a memoir, it doesn't have to be factually... correct anyway, does it? Is that the deal?
Oh, well, it kind of has to be.
Yeah,
you can't tell lies about people.
I know.
You know, you can't tell lies. You can't say this happened when it didn't
happen.
But
what's
you
your understanding of a memoir versus an autobiography?
Oh, I suppose an autobiography, you think you're important enough to that your life is interesting to other people,
right.
Whereas a memoir is more subjective in a way, isn't
right,
it?
I suppose,
more kind of more drifting.
Neil Jordan with Ray and with Oliver, another screenwriter. His name is Tony Schumacher and he is the man behind the TV series The Responder with Martin Freeman, a police officer under a lot of pressure. And Schumacher acknowledges he drew a lot from his own life for this series, but he only started writing in his 40s. So let us begin at the beginning. It is one hell of a story.
Like, as a kid growing up, did you, in your head... You always knew you wanted to be a writer.
Oh my God, yeah. Yeah, that was my dream. I was like, I must have been the worst mate in the world to have. Like if we were playing games or something like that, you know, on the streets or something, like I'd like always be the one who'd say, right, okay, this is what we're playing. This is what we're going to do. This is how it's going to be. You stand over there. You say that. You fall over when you get shot. You do this. No, fall over like that. I'd just do all of that kind of thing. And then if I was kicking a can down the road, I wouldn't just kick a can down the road and do a commentary. I'd do the press conference afterwards. So I was like, I was just obsessed with like that whole thing, you know.
School was not for him, not at all. Fair to say, he turned his hand to quite a lot of things.
It's like it's a real car crash of a career, a CV, you know. I was a roofer and then winter came, it was freezing cold, we had a terrible winter, so I thought, I'm not doing this anymore. And I went and got a job working in a jeweller's shop, I worked there for a while.
It's a big change, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was, big chains as well. And it was, then I went to work in an animal feed company, then I drove a van, then I sold trucks, then I worked in pubs, it just goes on and goes on and goes on. I ended up working abroad in bars and in the Caribbean and on cruise ships and stuff and just bumbling around, you know.
He saw an ad in the newspaper and ended up applying for a job as a first responder, the person on the scene after a 999 call. He would go on to do it for 13 years, a job he loved, until he didn't.
It was fantastic, you know. I used to love that thing when I was racing down streets of a night, like at 3, 4 in the morning, and you'd see your blue lights flashing off the windows as you were racing past. It was so exciting.
Wow.
And it was great, you know, and you'd always have this adrenaline going. Mm. But what I hadn't noticed was it was affecting me in ways that it shouldn't do, you know. It was that, like, I started hunting for that adrenaline, and then it became harder and harder and harder to find, you know. And what I now know, that was PTSD. But at the time,
wow,
I just thought I was getting bored.
It all caught up with him and he had a breakdown.
My, like, final breakdown, the final thing, I got beat up a few times at work. And then I think that obviously had an effect on me that I hadn't
for
noticed.
Sure, yeah.
And the bones put back together and stuff. And then I had about a month of bad jobs, and I won't go into details because, you know, it's 9 o'clock, like, but I had a month of, like, really bad jobs of things that were upsetting me over and over and over, and I didn't recognize it. I just didn't realize, you know, that I was breaking down. Then all of a sudden I just went. It was like a twig just cracked and I couldn't do the job anymore, and that was that, you know.
What did that breakdown look like?
Oh, mate, like panic attacks. I used to cry in a car all the way home, couldn't sleep, drinking, arguing, struggling to control my temper. You know, just awful stuff, you know. Like, I remember I was buying dog food one night, you know, walking around Asda, and it's like 2 a.m. and I'm on my way home because I've been working, like, all day, you know, and I'm going home at 2 a.m. And I'm sobbing my eyes out at the self-service checkout. You know, it's weird. It's just the weirdest thing. And you think it's normal. And you go home at, like, 3 a.m, or you get home at 3 a.m. because you don't want to get in and be sobbing downstairs in case your wife hears you, you know. And you get home and just get, like, blind drunk, get up and go to work in the morning. It's crazy. And you think it's normal. You think it's really quite normal. It's so strange.
His marriage collapsed, and very quickly, in about 8 weeks or so, he became homeless.
I ended up living in my car with my dog and too ashamed to tell people. There's a beach in Liverpool called Crosby Beach. It's a beautiful place. Get down there if you can. But and I just ended up living in this car, you know, freezing cold, middle of winter, frost on the windows of a night, you know, and me and the dog living in the car. And I was out the police, but I think people used to think I was still in. So I'd, like, pop into police stations and have a shower occasionally, or I'd have a wash in McDonald's or something like that. You know, I was just living in this kind of weird hinterland between, like, what people assume is life and what isn't, you know. And then the MOT was used to expire in the car, and I was panicking because I was thinking, if this goes, I can't. You know, I'm knackered, like, I can't stay in the car because it'll get...
This is home. This is all you have.
Yeah, I was really panicking about it. And, like, weeks were going by, and so strange. It's so weirdly, a mate of mine just reached out to me on the phone. He said, I haven't seen you for a while. And I just told him. I hadn't told anyone else. Family, nobody. I was so embarrassed. I just told him what was going on. And he was great. You know, he stepped in, pulled me up and got me back on my feet, you know.
Kind of amazing. But how, you might be wondering, did he get from there to the author and lauded screenwriter we're hearing about today? Well, he was working as a taxi driver when one fare turned out to be a magazine editor. He pitched her a few ideas.
She spotted talent, obviously, and said, keep going. Yeah.
Yeah, I think she spotted someone to fill a few inches in a magazine, to be honest with you, more likely that. But then I started writing in... And just fell back into it again. It just was good for my soul. It changed me as a person, you know. And I found that outlet that I've been looking for all my life. And, you know, I'm a better person for having written. And I recommend it to anyone. If anyone's sitting on a script, if anyone's sitting on a book and a manuscript, get it out there. Put it online. And even if you don't want to get it out there and put it online, just enjoy doing it. Just enjoy writing it.
Tony Schumacher with Oliver. And on Sunday nights, a new offering presented by Rachel Hegarty, Poetry People and That Trickiest of Questions. What is a poem? Simon O'Connor of the Museum of Literature of Ireland, Molly. He bravely took a stab.
As part of our current exhibition here at Molly, there's a poem by Christodoulos Makris called Chances Are.
and it's a projected, ever-changing Twitter feed of comments containing the word chance. Looking at it, you realise that a poem is maybe not a way of writing. Perhaps poetry is a way of watching, a way of listening, and a way of telling. But it's also a conversation with language, with communication itself. I like to think that if alien anthropologists were studying the human race, they would single out poetry as our highest form of transmission, the most effective, the most artful use of our language, in a way, the most truthful way of speaking to one another. For many years, I used to begin every morning by reading a poem. And that brief and, I suppose, potent dose of heightened language got my mind going for the day. I highly recommend it.
Well, with all of that in our heads, let's have a listen to this poem from Derek Mann.
The Chinese restaurant in Portrush. Before the first visitor comes the spring, softening the sharp air of the coast in time for the first seasonal invasion. Today the place is as it might have been, gentle and almost hospitable. A girl strides past the Northern Counties Hotel, light-footed, swinging a book bag, and the doors that were shut all winter against the north wind and the sea mist lie open to the street, where one by one the gulls go window shopping and an old wolfhound dozes in the sun. While I sit with my paper and prawn chow mein under a framed photograph of Hong Kong, the proprietor of the Chinese restaurant stands at the door as if the world were young, watching the first yacht hoist a sail, an ideogram on sea cloud, and the light of heaven upon the hills of Donegal, and whistles a little tune, dreaming of home.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. Is it fair to say things are a little bit scary, or at least they feel that way? War, chaos, instability, and let's not forget about the climate. So time, perhaps, for a play that reminds us that we have been here before. This is nothing new. It's called Children of the Sun, and it is coming to the Abbey stage. And this is Hilary Fannin's reworking of Maxim Gorky's original 1905 text. Director Lynn Parker joined Sean on Arena.
It seems to be a play, Lynn, that is done at times when people are in dread fear that something awful is going to happen in the world, which might explain why you're doing it right now.
Well, Gorky wrote it before the whole seismic revolution in Russia, but he said it back in the 19th century during a cholera epidemic. So, you know, pandemics, what have you. And, of course, we are doing it now in the face of seismic changes all around the world. But actually, when the play was first performed, there were riots in the wake of one of the productions. And then, you know, at the same time, the Abbey was setting up and there were riots around its plays. Yeah. And so that you, what we're really looking at is the fact that, well, plus ça change, you know, we keep looking at these shifts in the human experience, in political life and personal life, and we don't seem to be able to escape certain cycles of it. So when we started to look at this play, it was some years ago, and well before Ukraine and well before Gaza and all of that. And really, the play is not about any of these things. Mm. It's about our inability to escape conflict, partly by being able, apparently, to avoid looking at it.
And at the heart of this play, time, and the character of scientist Protasov, played by Stuart Graham.
He's full of ideas. He's a scientist. He firmly believes he is on the cusp of a discovery involving time and or ability to use time to our own advantage. He firmly believes that there are parallel universes out there, and that through the evolution of us as a species, we will at some point be able to transverse those different parallel
universes. We'd be able to be the three of us sitting in this studio now, but we could equally be three similar people in a totally different situation in 100 years' time.
Correct. And he believes
ideally
through
our perfect selves.
And we can go back, therefore, and undo all of the mistakes. Yeah. Undo, you know, and fix everything that we got wrong. Like Lynn was saying, the play deals with, you know, not just our inability to see conflict when it's right in front of us, but also our propensity to redo the mistakes of the past, to let history repeat itself, both in a society, in society's terms, but also in an individual's terms.
But if all of that sounds a little bit gloomy, take heart. It has some great music, courtesy of Mel Mercier. Children of the Sun on Arena. But keeping the chaos fresh, artificial intelligence. British Canadian computer scientist and cognitive psychologist Professor Geoffrey Hinton has been described as the godfather of AI. He spoke to Drive Time and Cormac's opening question, not short on the drama.
I don't think I've ever started a conversation with the following question, but tell me how your project that you worked on for years could pose a risk to humanity.
So the big chatbots we have now actually understand language very well. They really do understand it. And they're getting to be close to humans in intelligence. And there's no reason why they should stop. So most people in the field believe they're going to get smarter than people. We've never had to deal with anything smarter than people before. We just don't know what's going to happen. And it's not obvious that we'll stay in control. If you ask, how many examples do you know of where a more intelligent thing is controlled by a less intelligent thing? And the only example I know of is a mother and baby, where evolution put a lot of work into allowing the baby to control the mother.
And ultimately, this outcome.
What could happen then?
They could get much smarter than us. They could decide that they can run things better than we can. But we could give them goals. So the first problem is you could give them a goal like stop climate change. Seems like a good goal. Mm-hmm. And they could then figure out the way to do that is get rid of people. That's not very likely because we would probably specify the goal a bit more carefully than that. Mm. But we could also give them the ability, in fact, we've done this already, give them the ability to create sub-goals. So, for example, if you want to get to America, you have a sub-goal, which is to get to the airport. And you have to give these AIs the ability to create sub-goals in order for them to be really effective at organising holidays for you and things like that. But they will realise very soon that a very good sub-goal is to get more control. Because if you have more control, you can achieve your other goals better. And we do that all the time. Any politician, they probably start off life wanting to help people, but pretty soon their main aim is to get control and stay in control. Mm. And these things could go the same way. And so they could eventually get much more control than people.
And as the interview went on, it was increasingly disconcerting to listen to Professor Hinton. His simple logic, borderline chilly. Take his response to Sarah's, hey, let's just turn them off question.
Can we not plug them out? Do we not ultimately have the control?
Yes, this is what I call the big switch argument, and it doesn't work. Some people think it does work. Eric Schmidt, for example, who advises the US military and used to be chairman of Google, thinks you can have some kind of big switch where you turn it off if it's dangerous. I don't believe so. Suppose these things are much smarter than us and have learned from us, and they're much more persuasive than us. They'll talk to the guy who controls, or girl, who controls the big switch and persuade them that it would be very silly to turn off the big switch.
I'm sorry, that's just not a good idea. So how long until we bow to our AI overlords? Only half joking.
My best guess would be there's a chance of like 50% that sometime between 5 and 20 years from now they'll get smarter than us.
Lovely, ruled by our Fitbit. On Drive Time. But if all of that has left you trembling, looking askance at the kettle as it plots world domination, calm down. We're going to go over to Liveline, I know. But it was a soothing balm in crazy times.
Gubnet, Gubnet Kelly, good afternoon.
And thus began the Liveline listeners naming a child. Okay, not quite. Bear with us. But on Monday, Joe was chatting about the Irish Navy renaming two ships. They're now Aveen and, yes, Gubnet.
Are you delighted that a new warship is going to be named after you?
Well, a warship, maybe a protection vessel. Can we call it that instead?
Oh, yeah, but it has weapons.
Okay, I'm not here to argue that.
Okay, now you...
Two great names are going to give them.
Gubnet and Aveen.
Yeah, great Irish names with great histories. My mother's name is Gubnet, and my name is Gubnet, and my daughter's name is Sarah Gubnet, and my nieces are Gubnets as well, so it's a family name.
Gubnet, 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 and Gubnet. No shortage of the Gubnets there. But, as Joe pointed out, a dearth of Gubnets more widely. We just love saying Gubnet. And according to the CSO, good Irish names have been usurped by the likes of Jack and Grace. Bringing us to Wednesday and the opening call. Nicola, she's from Meath, but she now lives in Chicago. And she had this task for Liveline listeners. Name my baby.
I'm due in 2 weeks.
Yes.
And my husband is Welsh.
Okay.
I'm Irish.
Welsh, okay.
And he has a Cornish last name, so kind of looking for Celtic names. And I thought I was kind of interested in the way Gubnet was an interesting name, but I'm not sure I'd 100% go for that one.
Okay, so Gubnet, let's be clear. Gubnet is gone.
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Father is Welsh. You're from Ireland. What part of Ireland, Nicola?
Just outside Ashburn, County Meath.
County Meath, the Royal County. Okay, people are... And you know it's going to be a girl, is that correct?
Yes, yeah. Okay. So looking for girls' names.
Okay. Well, would that be a criteria that we might apply? You're looking for a name that is straightforwardly pronounced.
I think in
the States, for example.
Exactly. And easy enough for people to, when they're reading it, they can pronounce it maybe phonetically, would be handy.
Okay. So does that mean Saoirse and Siobhan are gone?
Probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
I understand. I understand. And I appreciate you asking us to come on board to help. So Saoirse, so you want it pronounceable, you want it easily read.
What followed was, I think it's fair to say, one of the most unusual lifelines and strangely hypnotic.
Okay. My suggestion would be Grian, Grian, as in the sun, because the baby saw the sun yesterday, or the eclipse.
I'm suggesting Fiona.
Oh, lovely. And
it's an easy name, and I think it would go with her surname. And I have a granddaughter who lives in California, and the name's been a great success.
The name that I like, actually, is Blanet.
Okay.
And I think it's a very easy name to pronounce. And also, I have never heard the name Blanet shortened. The meaning of it is flower or blossom.
Flower or blossom. Okay. Don't move there, Audrey. Nicola, spell Blanet as you're writing it down. Spell it out loud for me.
I spelled it Blanad, but I know that's not right.
You see, that's the problem. That is the problem. This is nonstop. Ah, Margaret, are you serious?
I am.
You can't be serious.
It is Oakley.
Annie Oakley.
No, just Oakley.
Okay, what does it mean?
It's an oak meadow. It's a very old Irish name, and it's oak meadow or the meadow of the oak tree.
Okay.
Possibly Railtine, but it could be difficult for the Americans. But
okay. And what I see you're mentioning Tara as well, which a lot of people are T-A-R-A. Obviously, T-A-R-A.
Yeah, Nicola's from County Meath.
Yeah.
So the Royal County.
Yeah. Do you know any Taras, Nicola? Is there any Taras in the family?
I don't.
Do you not know?
No, I don't know any Taras. No.
Well, that's interesting.
My friend's son was born on a Tuesday, and I think the Gaelic for Tuesday was Lune.
Yeah, I thought that was the Gaelic for Monday.
It was Monday then.
Yeah.
But whatever day the baby was born on, it's a great and unique way for naming them, you know, in Gaelic.
My suggestion is Sunniva. It's an ancient Irish name, and Saint Sunniva basically escaped to Norway, and she's venerated over in Norway particularly, but it is an Irish name, and it's spelled exactly the way it said and spelled, so S-U-N-N-I-V-A. Can't get it wrong.
But given that there's no V in the Irish alphabet, how does that qualify?
That's what I was thinking about that.
Yeah, well, think more. Think more, Nicole. Think more. And, keep thinking. Yeah, when the baby comes back to Ireland, you'll be only 10 minutes in Nobber before someone is saying son of a gun.
I think it's a lovely name.
I do, but I agree. We're trying to work out the permutations, Gail. I understand you, but we're trying to work out the possibility.
I think it's a lovely name. I've only ever come across it's within her parameters, which is an Irish name, and how to spell it correctly.
Okay, well,
Oh, Nicola, well, you did phone in. And in 2 weeks' time, yeah, you will have a newborn. So you better expect the call from Joe. We are naming your baby. And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.